in your own writing of all kinds, I'll speak figuratively of poetry and just kind of use that as a signal for all kinds of expressive writing, or writing where you're really paying attention to whether or not the words express, you know, who you are and what's been happening with you and so on. Excuse me. So inviting you to, as you go along the process, have yourself a secure enough kind of place that you can read your work aloud to yourself. My family's used to this. My children grew up with it. I'm sure my wife thought it was a little odd at first. But find yourself a secure place where you can go off and read out loud to yourself. Slowly. It's a really good way to check what you're doing. And see how it's, you know, how it shimmies out there in the air. It never has quite the same life, no matter how imaginative we are, just to read it silently to ourselves, to see if it's working or not, you know, but if it's accomplishing what we had hoped or if it's surprised. The purpose of poetry, I shall just quote Annie Dillard, is to delight. Okay. That doesn't mean delight. I mean, I think we often use delight as, you know, where it comes to delightful and those kind of, you know. But delight, as I understand earlier meanings, is any kind of strong charge. Okay, we can be delighted by something that it almost, you know, gives us the willies, you know. But at least we're not rock center anymore. We're off balance somewhat. There's some delight there. There's some stirring there. And I'm for functional poetry. Poetry that has use. It's not adornment somehow. It's not effete with its pinky in the air. You know, but it's functional. So the purpose of poetry, Annie Dillard would say, or I agree with her down the line, is the purpose of poetry and expressive writing is to delight. So to see whether or not it's delighting us as the author, it's well to read out loud. Well, does anybody have any piece that they did a work on them from yesterday having to do with the kitchen or with anything that happened since or whatever, they'd like to float out here in front of other ears? We'll be very kindly to it. I'm not the sort of person who likes to jump on something and say, yes, that's wonderful, and I approve, and you should, or no, here, a person should never write again. But it is nice to just be accepting and so on. So anybody got something?
Yes.
Okay, good.
All right, so I'll go first.
Resting person, that's all right.
I call this pancakes.
Oh, good.
Vague wisps of smoke escaped from the metal chimney when Graham jammed another chunk of alder into the firebox of the squat black stove. She moved the aluminum kettle to the back and she brought out the skillet. Time for Graham's pancakes. Go into the pantry and bring me some clabbered milk. Don't spill it now. The cement floor felt slightly damp. And the flat cans of milk resting within reach on low shelves and a cream can which was temptingly near. Drawing a funny face in the thick cream and hurrying back before she turns around. Set out the plates and don't forget the napkin rings. And for goodness sakes, move that cat from my mending basket. Grease splatters from the skillet and it hops across the stove lids. The kettle is purring a soft whisper, and pancake smell starts to cling to hair and clothes. Lilacs in a fruit jar pick up the thin sun rays and cast a slight shadow on the log cabin syrup. Quickly now, run and tell him I said to wash his hands and wipe his feet. Breakfast is ready.
Well.
Yay.
Yeah. Sounds hung, sounds good.
Now, if I could ask you, just sort of policy questions, procedural kinds of things, is that something you think about often or something that hadn't really come to mind in a while? Or?
This is my grandmother's kitchen.
It's your grandmother's kitchen, and does it come to mind often or is it?
Lately, as I get older, it's coming to mind more often because yeah. things are not that way anymore.
Yeah, well, yeah.
The old black stove,
wood stove
is dead.
Stuff, yeah.
Grease.
Yeah. I've been burned by that grease, so yeah. I know that it hops across yeah. the stove with that.
That was a first hearing for me, and I really appreciate you reading that aloud. And there are several things that seem to happen. Images we got, mm-hmm. loads of images, uh-huh. And by that we mean, again, I don't think I can underline this quite enough. Not just visual images, but all other kinds of sensory images as well. A lot of music in it, especially the short A sound from the title forward. Pancakes, granddad, cat. What was the wood that went into the stove right away?
Alder.
Mm-hmm. A lot of that sound. That's a linkage of musicality, okay? And so that could be said to be sort of a major thematic, you know, in that. If that were a musical composition, we would say that's one of the major things. It's kind of holding that piece together. That's part of the major warp of that weaving. Mm-hmm. Is that ah sound? And in a piece, if we let ourselves kind of free to it, we often will do that. We often will come up with something that is kind of the linkage for a piece. Also, of course, there's some contrast, but there is a unifying sound or a unifying rhythm or something, you know, kind of depending on who we are and what we bring to the piece of writing. Did you catch? Let's see if your favorite metaphor was my favorite word metaphor. What did you catch the metaphor? The simile there that was so well placed.
Was it the cat?
Yeah. The kettle purring like a cat.
Yeah, and then the cat was.
And the cat in the mending basket.
And the cat in the mending basket.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So we have this sort of. Now again, I'll say that there's a strong thing that you can do in any of your writing. Called transferal, I don't know if that's spelled right, transferal. And what that means is having an image from one sense, but expressing that in the language of another sense. And so, if it's an image that is typically heard, but we express that as being something tactile, that's transferal. And we often do that in our daily speech. A lot of good writing is just good speaking, you know, rich speaking. Speaking that is not mundane, you know. Let's go back here and I'll draw this little guy that we talked about the other day. That lung man. And gosh, isn't he cute? But anyway. These are the four ways that we can pretty much measure how we handle language arts. Listening, talking, reading, and writing. And these are universal to humanity. Any culture that has all four of those, that's not a preliterate culture or something, this is the sequence that you get them in. And you'll notice it's just like breathing, okay? If we had a little ear on lung man here. As an infant, you listen to a lot. That's information in. And then from that, you learn speech. That's information out. And then reading is information in again. And then writing is information out again. It's just like that. There's another one that we're identifying now in learning labs and language labs called logical critical thinking. And we know that comes from a particular part of the brain. And why I'm bringing this up is they know these sort of biological and educational laboratory persons, they know that the human activity that most engenders strength of logical critical thinking is expressive writing. I'm not talking didactic writing or term paper writing, but personally expressive writing. They don't know why yet. They're still working on that one.
Repeat that again. What's the link there?
Pardon?
What's the link there?
The link is that in order to get better at logical critical thinking, you need to do a lot of expressive writing. Not didactic writing, but expressive writing, personal writing. Writing of who you are and your own concerns and so on. As I say, they don't know why yet, but they know that that's the case. And this is odd. It's one of those weird ironies. They know that, for example, it takes about 20 years before something is known clinically or in the laboratory until it gets actually practiced. You know, DDT is an example. I knew about that for years, but until the soldiers in World War II were dying of malaria, you know, they didn't put it to use, and then boom, they got that thing on the line. You know, they got it on the lines of where they didn't really test it, like what it would do to birds and retrocarson and all that kind of stuff. But this is another example where we know this, but what happens? Employers and college recruitment people and so on say, well, why is it people can't write a logical paper? Or parents say, my kid doesn't have a logical thought. They can't think it through and see what the consequences are. It's because there's not enough expressive writing going on. What we think we got to do is put on more research writing, more term papers and stuff. That's not really true. In many cases, it's like this. If you want better math scores, teach more music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Music was part of math in medieval universities, clear up until then. Yeah.
It isn't kind of like what happened here. You know, there was reductive thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, she was going back in your history.
Exactly.
And drawing it forward. So is that kind of...
You said it much better than I was going to. Say it again.
Well, I think it's like reflective thinking. That's what she was doing. She was going back. She was following her history. But then she was taking that moment and she was bringing it into some kind significance now.
Right, exactly.
Is that one of the reasons journaling is so
important? Oh, absolutely.
That creates that linkage.
Yeah, exactly. And we cut ourselves off. See, my assertion is that everybody deserves several try-on experiences with different kinds of arts to see which one might be your lifelong arts, much as there are lifelong sports. I think the school system will have done us a disservice if by the time you're 18 you haven't had a chance to try on photography, creative writing, a little bit of clay, the piano, voice, and see which ones kind of are yours, you know, and that you can kind of stick with and enjoy and, you know, interact with. So it's not drudgery to practice a piano because it's, you know, it's a part of you, you know, that's... and creative writing is an odd critter because it engenders this thing, which is pretty amazing. That's true, that if you study music, you get better at math. They're finding in those kind of retirement communities that there's a lot being done right now with play therapy. And it's the tactile art that's causing a lot of reawakening of stuff, and people who have been forgetful, not Alzheimer's, but just forgetful or disinterested, or whatever, it's the clay therapy that's, you know. William Blake says that there's another one, and that's the imagination itself. He actually perceives the imagination as, you know, a sense. That's the, you know, a sense that we have. He also perceives that as a sort of character that lives in us, a personality, a several personality that lives in us. It's quite interesting if you can wade through some of his reading. Well, a transferal then was where I was going with that, and that has to do with expressing one piece of sensory information with another. Any others to read?
Please.
Please.
The kitchen of my teens. It was a normal kitchen of the 40s, but the memories it triggers convert it to an integral part of my teenage home life. The hot point stove, with the oven rising well above the four burners at its side, reminds me of all the aromatic hot breads my mother baked for breakfast and evening snacks. Cornbread with bacon bits on the top, baking powder biscuits with orange marmalade, big muffins, and our favorite popovers dripping with honey. Then there was the time I decided to surprise the family by making cornbread. All went well until I cut it to serve. It was white. It was tasteless. Mother asked, "Marion, did you add salt?" "Yes, I did." "Sugar?" "Yes." "What about cornmeal?" "Uh-oh." No wonder the cornbread was white. Years later, that oven played a more important role in my life. It was supposed to cook a pork roast for dinner when we were going to entertain a college student from the University of Washington that a relative in Texas asked Mother to contact. The oven thermostat broke and charred the roast and smoked the house while Mother was out. So we went to a restaurant where things did not go well, in my opinion, and I became grouchy. Later, the young man reciprocated by taking me out to dinner. Also, he admitted later, after we were married, he wanted to see if I was really as impossible as I appeared to be that night. The breakfast nook at the end of the kitchen brings back memories, too. It was a cheery room with windows on two sides, but the gate-legged table and four chairs almost filled it from wall to wall. The four of us each had a side, my father furthest in, away from the kitchen. One day, my father painfully bit his tongue and slammed his hand down on the table with a crash and expletive. My brother and I shot out of our chairs like rockets into the kitchen, not knowing what had happened and thinking he wanted out. My father was startled by our reactions and remorseful. Another poignant memory of that kitchen is of our dog that lived there when not outside. I particularly remember one night when I had done something to displease my parents and it seemed my world had fallen apart. I went into the kitchen and the dog gave me his usual joyful welcome, and suddenly the world was right again in that ordinary kitchen.
Thank you for reading. And do we have a sense of place? You betcha. Okay. And it was almost overlooked. I mean, it was put in there so subtly, you know, that she married this guy. Mm-hmm. We're kind of wondering, weren't we? You know, and it was just no big deal, no fanfare. You know, it was almost. Pardon?
Later
after we were married. You know,
but it led into it though.
It's kind of an afore-drawn conclusion. You know, later after we were married. That's. Yeah, I think we find that has much to recommend it, and that probably has an audience somewhere, as did the other piece, actually. And I, you know, that audience might be a family, that audience might be a reminiscence in a church newsletter, if your church newsletter does that kind of thing, might be in some other, you know, publication, Lutheran Women Today, or, you know, whatever. I think that there's, you know, more people are publishable than they know. If you know, honest people, you know, if we're trying to be flim-flam persons, then we don't deserve to be published, and of course that's why they aren't published, and you know, because it's transparent that they think very little of our ability to ferret our way through you know, something that's preposterous and you know, uncaring. But something like this, it's really caring and has a genuine connection. It's probably got an audience out there somewhere. Look around for it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you. I remarked to Norma's when she read it to me last night that I think that should be saved for her family.
Oh, yeah.
Because that period, that's a past generation.
It's
that
gone.
Should be valuable to her children and grandchildren.
Yeah, it's exactly like a picture, and I'm reminded of the fact that in maybe a generation or two before mine, that people often took or had a photographer take a picture of the interior of their home. And so you'd have a picture of the parlor, and it would have the organ in this corner, and it kind of had all the good stuff scooted to the middle, you know. And so it'd have the lace curtains all pressed and so on, and the organ scooted in, and the best rocking chairs in the picture, and maybe there's a Christmas tree over here in one corner if they did it for that time of year. They're black and white. You know, and this is exactly like one of those photographs. It's a record, you know. That's a good thing that you said that. Yes?
In addition to family that treasure this, I think it's important that an archive near where this was located, they would also treasure this record.
Yeah.
We have researchers coming to the archive all the time looking for how was it when my
really makes you feel kind of old, you guys.
Well, I mean,
older than I am.
I certainly, recognize that a lot of stuff that happened to me when I was a kid, and I'm 47, and a lot of stuff that happened to me when I was a kid I don't know if that feels to me old, or I guess it depends on which day I got up, but. But a lot of stuff that happened to me, it doesn't happen anymore.
That's true, right?
You know, things are changing so fast. I mean, we used to have party lines, you know.
Yeah.
My kids, I can't even explain to them what that means. You mean, are other people talking on the telephone? You
know? Other people listening in.
Are other people listening on your telephone? All that kind of stuff.
You mean you actually have wires connecting the headsets?
Yeah. Yeah. If you had to walk across the room to turn on the TV, well, actually, we didn't have a TV.
Well, I really think, I can almost pinpoint this year, but I think it's 1935. So it is quite a while ago.
Well, see if you want to do something with it. I'm not for pushing people, but if you want to do something with it, you know. It might be that there are people out there who would appreciate it. We did, so. Thanks to both of you. Anybody else? If you would, Jim.
This doesn't look good. I've been wanting to write about the faucet on the wall. The faucet hanging from the wall really, truly saw it all hanging from the wall. Saw my crying, my surviving, my futile war against the rage hanging from the wall. Saw me tearing up the lettuce, cutting greens and red tomato hanging from the wall. Saw the sugar added, Mama's secret little recipe, such a good boy, hanging from the wall. See this now, old faucet. I've changed a few designs. There's no more need for sugar or things hanging from the wall.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Piece of litany happening in there that's hanging from the wall. Images, loads of those, color. It's odd to me, but I tend to think and identify color a lot. It's odd to me how many people will write a page of writing and mention no colors whatsoever. My name. I can't conceive of that. I can't go the first hour in the morning without having mentioned 9 colors. You know, and all of us are different. But I mean, just it seems to me that I know that there are 10 million colors discernible with the human eye. I read that on slick paper 3 times, so it's got to be true.
Oh my!
10 million colors, you know, and that's not all the colors there are. That's just the ones that God gave us the ability to capture. But yeah, color is a very quick way to take people right into. The where you are, you know, the tomatoes, the lettuce, the, you know, so on and so on. There's a chrome faucet, I guess.
Yeah,
reflective. Mm-hmm.
So it had that mirror quality about it, and the magic of, I mean, just the whole, the entire history of literary mirrors. From mirror, mirror on the wall, it was the fairest of them all, clear on back and forward and throughout cultures and so on. The watching mirror.
Well, for me, the one thing that always attracted me to that faucet is I've spent years, about 8 years since 1976, designing kitchens. Mm-hmm. And I've eliminated a lot of wall faucets. And every time I go in and take out a wall faucet of somebody's house or design, if you remember that, I remember that one. And the work that I've done recently is taking me from hanging on the wall and taking all these memories out, dusting them off, putting them in perspective, finding forgiveness, and a place for them.
Yeah, there's obviously a crucifixion suggestion there in the on the wall is a person who has felt crucified, a person who's felt on display, a person who's felt hung out to dry, we would say, you know, etc. That's a brave bunch of stuff there, thank you. And I'm going to say that one probably would find a publishing home. Not that that's the aim of anything we're doing here, but well, certainly a lot of people ought to hear it, a lot of people ought to read it. To my view. Any others?
Yeah.
Would you?
I don't have any to read. I just felt like the sense of the past crucifixion has a reflection in itself, picking up on that idea of reflecting quality forward in time, so the potential for the image of being hung. Mm-hmm. Or hanging oneself is sitting there, and then he smacks into it with that cut red tomato, you know, and you get the little lurch in your throat, and you think, what? So it's a very interesting tension that you develop.
And it's suggestive of a lot of different. Mm-hmm.
Are these subliminal thoughts he has that are coming out in the writing? Or is this coincidental?
I think I'll ask Jim to answer that, and then I have an answer too.
Everything in there is pretty well there. I mean, it's one of those things where
you're conscious of.
Oh yeah.
Of course.
I found out after years why my mom's salad tasted so much better than anybody else's, because she used to add a little sugar.
Yeah.
And there were some offenses in the family. The family wasn't a real functional family, and out of that, my role as for all the things that it was, one thing that they kind of sugar-coated, play on words intended, was that I'm such a good boy, and that was always coated over, and, you know, I don't need that sugar anymore. I can take that out of the picture and see things for what it is, you know. Mm-hmm. I've made reconciliation with my mom and all that kind of stuff, but,
so this is really loaded then with deep thoughts.
Yeah. I've worked on this one for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've wanted to write about this faucet on the wall for about 5 years, and then when I started drawing out the layout of my family home, I didn't just draw the kitchen, I remember the hallways and...
Oh, you did the whole house, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, because having been a kitchen designer, I see things in bird's eye view real clearly, you know. Anyway.
Or did we drop one out in front of this guy? He's a kitchen designer. Yeah, and my answer to that is that in any piece, there's stuff that one places there. There's also stuff that one tells on oneself without knowing, you know. And the reader comes along, and I will say this about writing, it seems to me, about expressive writing, that if there's an attention to the real and the gentle and the genuine and so on, if it's not flim-flam stuff, if it's not showy, you know, for the person, the purpose of sort of gratification of ego or whatever, that the reader will get all kinds of stuff, subliminally and surface and handed to them and so on. Conversely, if it has a lot of razzle-dazzle about it, a lot of times leaves are ear flat, you know, because they recognize that they're being cajoled and condescended to and so on. Now, many times the reader will say, well, I found this, I found this, I found that. And as the writer, I say, well, good, you know. Did I put those things in there? Well, actually, no, I don't think I did. You know? So that's why I said the other day that it's up to us to provide, you know, the really good working with the words and let the reader have the ideas. You know, we can have our own ideas, of course, too, when it's finished. But you know, give the reader the reader's job to do. You know, let them have ideas. And for goodness sake, I would never say to the reader, well, you're completely wrong about my knees. What do you mean it changed your life and crushed you into things that you never thought of in 10 years and so on? You know, I say, wonderful, you know. Along with the notion, my friend Bill Stafford said this, that, and I always thought it was such a wonderful, non-argumentative way about things. You know, in the case of not defending a piece of writing or over-explaining it or trying to justify it, he said, when people tell me a poem of mine is not for them, I tend to believe them. I think that's a nice, you know, it's not butting heads. I think that's a nice way to do things, yeah. Not everything is for everybody, and that's... We all would like to have written something that's of universal appeal and understanding and generates peace and, you know, amends the whole world and stuff, but it's rare. So. Anybody else have something to read?
I have this strange poem because I don't usually write poetry.
Well, okay.
And I tried to write about my kitchen and I woke up this morning and I'm writing about the bathroom.
Good, you can just go to the
bathroom. So here it is.
This poem would be good. I mean, you'll have to be good for 8 or 10 poems here or something. I don't know. So,
anyway, it was after they told me my brother would die. I was 8 and he was 2. Death whispered, I'm real, in my dark bedroom that night, and my eyes refused to close. Then a small patch of yellow light appeared on the wall by the door. I followed it cautiously down the stairs to the bathroom and found my father sitting on a stool, leaning his elbows on his knees. The smell of smoke from his cigarette reached me, standing there shyly, halfway in, halfway out the door, unsure. My father was strong, and his words were strong too, often loud and pointed. But that night, he motioned me to come in and rub my back. He told me of the clinic and the cancer and the cutting that would come. But the ugly words were a wonder, almost a caress, when he spoke them. I stared at his eyes, then touched his wet cheek, and then went back up the stairs, lightly, full of grace.
Bingo. Well, if you haven't done much of this before, I recommend you keep doing it some more. I'd like to be encouraging without being forceful there. A lot of images. Okay, a lot of different senses going on, smell of the cigarette, visual, etc., I mean, a whole bunch of stuff going on. What a conclusion. Okay. What a gift passed between the father and the daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, where did that grace come from? Well, it came from that interchange. Didn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, when we're talking compressed, you know, a lot got done there with a minimum of words. Okay. Let me stop this just there again and kind of stress this, that, you know, a part of our writing and of our funneling our experience and our observations and so on into a shape that we would call, you know, a story or a poem or, you know, character sketch or essay, whatever it is, that compression is what makes it pop, you know. And when we allow it to be sort of loose and floppy and all over the place, you know, that does not excite us as a writer. It does not give us a charge. You know, it's this kind of compression that we've gotten in all of these, you know, where it's been honed down to where we get the essence the experience and the memory and the what lesson a person took from it, and you know what a person's made of it since, you know, in their interior life or whatever, or in their relationship, you know, as you mentioned, reconciling with your mother, those kinds of things. A lot of that stuff happens because we're down to just the essence of stuff. You know, there's not a lot of waiting to do, you know, through stuff that's of less interest or importance or, you know, whatever. And then let me think back to, you know, these operations I had on the board here about listening, talking, reading and writing. When our conversation with someone, when we're having a really worthwhile conversation with someone, that's often because, you know, we're so excited and we're so in the moment, we're so focused on what the other person's saying, and they're bringing out so much in us that we're just sharp and we're not casting about, and we're, you know, it's a pipeline, you know, between us and that other person. Somebody famous once said the most important things that happen in life happen between one person and one person. I don't know who said that, so I can't be name dropping, but it'd be nice if I could footnote my conversation with it so that you could go ahead and read whoever said that. But it's an interesting notion. And I noticed that in conversation. And I also noticed that in writing and reading. If you're going to pursue writing as one of your possible lifelong arts, a lot of it's going to be self-study. I'm just so convinced of that. I mean, I'll drop over dead right now if that's not what I think. I take my cue from this listening, talking, reading, writing thing. When you were a nipper, you were an expert listener. Okay. Why? And how do we know that? Well, nobody really sits you down and teaches you to listen. And nobody sits you down and teaches you to talk. But you see big people doing it, and they're having so much fun that you want a piece of that. You know. So you're just listening. Okay. And you were an expert teacher because you essentially taught yourself to talk. I know we help nudge babies along a little bit. Well, I'm using that as an analogy for writing. And so the analogy would be that by reading, by listening to people, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we write. And we do it ourselves. I mean, typically, I don't think anybody straps a baby in a little high chair, you know, and says, okay, now we're going to have our listening time and our talking time, and I'm going to teach you. And you know, by the way, there is a thing in the universe called an emu, and it looks about like this. And you know, so we just talk, and they pick it up, and you know, and it's the hardest thing we ever have to learn is to speak our own native language, and we do that by the time we're about 3 or 4. Think of it.
But babies are just stupid.
Yeah, little dummies. But they're so absorptive, and so I'm using an analogy there. That's how we learn to talk, and I think that's also how we learn to write. Just by continually reading and writing and churning through the memories and all that kind of stuff. I just think it's that's how we learn to write real stuff. Okay. Now, the title of today's session is really very much been exemplified in what you're talking about here, because today's session was titled something like making up your life as you go along, you know, or something like that. Do you recall the title of that? It's close enough.
Yeah.
And that's really what this is happening, because there's so much that's kind of been lost to us, or we haven't thought of it in a while, we haven't entertained that notion, and we, you know, so on. And by writing, it helps us pull that forward and make something of it. Make of it all that it can be for us. And make of it, you know, if you want to say it's a lesson, or it's a learning device, or a catharsis of some kind, whatever. Art has the power to do that in us. And, you know, I find by doing my little exercises and making up my things and putting down some words and stuff, I'm able to drag forth all kinds of stuff that really is essential for me to know. There we are back to the word essence again. It's essential for me to know. But I haven't known it in any useful way. It's just been hanging around back in there. This also brings me to the point that there isn't really a time when we can't write. Okay? And why I say that, I'm going to go back and draw the brain again. But, you know, it's, you know what it looks like. You've seen plenty of illustrations and pictures. Got little squiggles in it. It looks kind of like used gum. And these little hummers, of course, are called convolutions. And when you are born, you have a few of those. You don't come out as a brand new baby, you know, with your brain surface looking like a ping pong ball. You have some. And then as you grow older and older and experience more things and learn more things and so on, you get more and more and more and more and more of them. So now you've got a gazillion teen of them. Okay. And our language used to reflect that in an interesting turn of speech when we would be talking with another person. They'd say something surprising to us that we haven't, and so we'd say, "Oh, that's a new wrinkle." That's what I meant. And so everything you learn makes a new convolution, and they don't go away. Now, we invent language that suggests that we think that that's true, but I think it's just sort of dodging kind of language, you know. You say, I was going to do pretty well on the test there, but I forgot. Well, what happened? This little thing just pop out again, you know, and get smoother? No. You know. I like Mark Twain's word, I disremembered. I never say I forgot. I say I neglected to remember. That's when I'm really being hard on myself. Neglected. Because I forgot means I'm getting all scot-free. Well, I was going to bring it along, but I forgot. You know? And I think there's a real relationship between responsible talking and responsible writing. This is a construction that's irresponsible. Mr. Barnes is boring. English is boring. Literature is boring. Poetry is boring. Boring. The mall's boring. The movie's boring. That's a dodging kind of way of constructing our language, and I'm not for it. I'm not for the student saying to me, or my son or daughter saying to me, "I'm bored. I'm bored with what you're saying, Dad." I taught my children early, when you suddenly, you know, they would say, "Oh, you scared me, Daddy." "Well, no, I really didn't. I startled you. I didn't scare you, I just startled you." Now, are those important distinctions? I think so. Mm-hmm.
Words mean things.
Yeah, words mean things. And if we're going to be kind of, and I feel that now in standard American English, or any kind of American English, we're pretty slouchy with a lot of our wording of things. You know? And so, of course, people take a different impression from what we meant, or we say the wrong impression. Of course, we're confused in our interchanges with people on a conversational level, or, you know, whatever, or just, you know, people who write in the newspapers don't take enough care with words, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's because we're not really, what do we think with words? You know, that's why we can't remember something that happened when we were 6 months old, because we have no words yet. And once we start piling words in there, and you know, so on, then we have see, I used to say this, and I never do anymore, but when I used to be teaching all the time, I would say, "Put it in your own words," because that's what people said to me. That's an absolutely ridiculous statement. I haven't said that in 20 years. Put it in your own words. Because it already is in words. And by the way, whose are they? Well, that's just your own, you know. Thoughts are words. Now, feelings are something else. Feelings are not words. We make up words to describe feelings. We say, "I feel love, hatred, disappointment, disapproval," you know, so etc. But the feeling itself isn't words. But thoughts are words. That's what makes us, you know. And so to have language be our art of choice and need and expressive mode, you know, it's quite an intriguing thing. Nobody expects a painter, for example, to be particularly articulate. Say, "Well, what? Tell me about that painting."
"Well, it is the painting. I mean, the painting says what it is. It's blue and rose and has some perspective in it. And look at it, and if you don't get it, that's tough." But people expect the writer to be able to be articulate. And I think that's kind of rightfully so. You know?
I just think that it's important for us to and here's what I'm trying to lead around. I'm going to cut to the chase on this and just say that we're all here together today, and you yourself have chosen to be here because you already handle words in a different way than a lot of people. Or your interest wouldn't be shown by your having come here. Your life, the life of the mind, your interior life is a little different. The way you handle words in your head is a little bit different than a lot of people. I'm not saying it's superior or, you know, whatever, but it's just a different kind of animal. And you trust them in a little different way to be conveyors of emotion and thought and, you know, so on, of legitimate information and authentic information and so on. And you have conversations in there, you know. And you kind of try to plan out not only exactly what words you'll use, but what tone you'll put on them so that, you know, you can actually, you know, help the person to see the light or something instead of hurting them and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I have an aunt. I'm sure she has no way of working with words in there. She just kind of, you know, she's granddaughter. She's kind of cranky and you know, she just says what, I mean, there's no editor between the brain and the, you know, she just says things, and she just hurts people all the time. She has no idea, you know, none. You know? She never had any children. She's been alone most of her life, I think, actually. You know, she just has had very little interaction. Well, that's the extreme of who you aren't. Now, here would be my ideal sometime, would be that we would have the time to be together in this kind of way for a period of time, and at the end of the week, actually, you know, having had, say, 5 sessions, and maybe, I like sessions that are more than an hour long, and then actually have a sort of group reading at the end and invite in other people for it. And if that idea ever appeals to you, you might, you know, jot me a note or jot the village a note or, you know, kind of think that way, you know, about a sort of more formal Holden Village writing workshop segment, you know. It's something that I think this place would be grand for, you know, and there are now hundreds of writing workshops across this country. Most of them do not pivot on faith, you know. Most of them actually pretty much are pivoting on agnosticism or atheism, something. And most of them don't have this setting, although some of them, you know, are put in wonderful spots. But a Holden Village writing workshop, I think, could be a sort of a...
There's no place where people get farther away.
Yeah, that's right. You can't get farther
away. And talk about building a village.
Yeah. It's true. How are they for time? Oh, we're almost down there. Anybody have anything else to read before I sort of put a wrap on this thing? I am given to understand that I will teach a session next week and maybe two, in case anybody's here. I want to say about you that I think you've been a very brave lot. You've certainly been very courteous. And often in a group of about this size, when they've only gotten together for 2 or 3 one-hour shots, and maybe just 1 one-hour shot, people don't want to read and they don't want to trust anybody, and, you know, so on. And maybe it's our common bond of faith and so on that allows us to do that. Gosh, what a kindly and responsive group of people. You mind if I read you just a little something? It's not mine. I would commend this to you. It's certainly still in print. It's called The News of the Worlds by a guy who's been a good friend of mine for a long time, Ron Carlson. And I'm kind of trying to read in the same vein that we've been writing about and talking about here, just from personal experience and our own two things are coming to my mind right now, and so it's crowding out what I was going to say. One of them has to do with paraphrasing poetry, where somebody asked Robert Frost one time if he could explain what his poem meant. And he said, "You mean put it in worse words?" Which is kind of true. It's kind of true. was the other thing I was thinking. Well, that one took that one up. I'm just going to read you a little bit of this to get a little bit of the flavor and stuff. This is family stuff. Now, this guy's very well published, very well known, you know, and people who write quite a bit, read quite a bit, so on. He's published in all the big magazines.
What's his name?
Ron Carlson. Ron Carlson. He lives down now in Arizona. In Salt Lake City, there's an area called the Avenues, which is topographically shaped like this, but there are houses in it. And then those avenues are named from the bottom up, A, B, C, D, so on. So this is called the H Street Sledding Record. And I would invite you to think about how he starts with us immediately. Listen to lengths of sentences. I'll try to read them that way. And, that'll do. The last thing I do every Christmas Eve is go out in the yard and throw the horse manure onto the roof. It is a ritual. After we return from making our attempt at the H Street sledding record, we sit in the kitchen sipping eggnog and listening to Elise recount the sled ride, and Elise then finally goes to bed happily, reluctantly, and we finish placing Elise's presents under the tree, and we pin her stocking to the mantle with care, and Drew brings out two other wrapped boxes, which anyone could see are for me, and I slap my forehead and forgot to get anything for her at all for Christmas except the prizes hidden behind the glider on the front porch. I go into the garage and put on the gloves, and then in the yard, and I throw the horse manure on the roof. Drew always uses the occasion to call my mother. They exchange all the Christmas news, but the main purpose of the calls the last few years has been for Drew to stand at the window where she can see me out there lobbing the great turds up onto the snow on the roof and describe what I am doing to my mother. The two women take amusement from this. They say things like, "You married him and he's your son." I take their responses to my rituals as a kind of fond, subtle support, which it is. Drew had said when she first discovered me throwing the manure on the roof the Christmas that Elise was four, "You're the only man I've ever known who did that." See? A compliment. But now that Elise is eight, Drew has become cautious. "You're fostering her fantasies," I answer. "Kids grow up too soon these days." And then Drew has this. "What do you want her to do? Come home from school in tears when she's 15? Some kid in her class will have said, 'Oh, sure, Santa's reindeer shit on your roof, huh?'" All I can say to Drew then is, "Some kid in her class? Fine. I don't care what he says. I'm her father." I have thrown horse manure on the roof for 4 years now, and I plan to do it every Christmas Eve until my arm gives out. It satisfies me as a homeowner to do so. The wonderful amber stain that is developing between the swamp cooler and the chimney and is visible all spring, summer, fall as you drive down the hill by our house, and for the way the two rose bushes by the gutter spout have raged into new and profound growth during the milder months. And as a father, it satisfies me as a ritual that keeps my family together. Drew has said, "You want to create evidence? Let's put out milk and cookie and then drink the milk and take a bite out of the cookie." I look at her. "Drew, I don't like cookies. I never ate a dessert in my life." And like I said, Drew has been a good sport. Even the year I threw one glob short and ran a hideous smear on the kitchen window screen that hovered over us all until March, when I was able to take it down and go to the car wash. I obtained the manure from my friend Bob, more specifically from his horse Power, who lives just west of Wheaton. I ride out there the week before Christmas and retrieve about a bushel. Throw it on the roof a lump at a time, wearing a pair of welding gloves my father gave me. I put the brake on the sled in 1975 when Drew was pregnant with Elise, so we could still make our annual attempt at the H Street sledding record on Christmas Eve. It was the handle of a broken Louisville Slugger baseball bat and still had the precise 34 stamped into the bottom. I sawed it off square and drilled and bolted it to the rear of the sled so that when I pulled back on it, the stump would drag us to a stop. As it turned out, it was one of the 2 years when there was no snow, so we walked up to 11th Avenue and 8th Street, as we promised, rain or shine, sat on the flexible flyer in the middle of the dry street on a starry Christmas Eve, and I held her in my lap. We sat on the sled like two basketball players contesting possession of her belly. We talked a little about what it would be like when she took her leave from the firm and I had her home all day with the baby, and we talked remotely about whether we wanted any more babies, and we talked about the record, which was set on December 24, 1969, the first Christmas of our marriage, when we lived in the neighborhood on 5th Avenue, an old barn of a house, the total rent of which was $72.50, honest. Drew had given me that sled the very night, that very night. We walked out about midnight. Had been surprised by a blizzard. No wonder we took the sled and walked up around the corner down Page Street, up to 11th Avenue, and without speaking or knowing what we were doing, opening the door on the second ritual of our marriage. The annual sled ride, the first ritual was the word condition, and the activities it engendered in our droopy old bed. At the top, we scanned the city blurred in snow, set on my brand new Christmas sled, and set off. The sled rode high and effortlessly through the deep snow, and suddenly, as our hearts started and our eyes began to burn against the snowy air, we were going faster than we'd planned. We crossed 10th Avenue, nearly taking flight in the dip, and then descended in a dark rush, 9th, 8th, 7th, soaring across each avenue. My arms wrapped around Drew like a straitjacket to drag her off with me if a car should cross in front of us on 6th, 5th Avenue, 4th. All this took seconds, do you see, until a car did turn on 8th Street, headed our way, and we veered the sled sharply up over the curb, doused our speed in the snowy yard, one house from the corner of 3rd Avenue. Drew took a real faceful of snow, which she squirmed around and pressed into my neck, saying the words, "Now that's a record." And it was the record, 11th to 3rd. And it stood partly because there had been two Christmas Eves with no snow, partly because of assorted spills brought on by too much speed, too much laughter, sometimes too much caution, and by a light blue Mercedes across 6th Avenue just in front of us in 1973. And though some years were flops, there was nothing about Christmas that at least looked forward to as much as our one annual attempt at the H Street sledding record. Just a moment. I think Drew wants another baby. I'm not sure, but I think she wants another child. The signs are subtle. They barely seem to add up, but she says things like, "Remember before Elise was went to school?" And, "There sure are lots of women in their mid-30s having babies. I should ask her, but for some reason I don't." We talk about everything, everything, but I've avoided this topic. I've avoided talking to Drew about this topic because I want another child too badly for her not to want one. I say a little boy, I want a little boy to come into the yard on Christmas morning and say, "See, there on the roof, the reindeers were there. I want another kid to throw horse manure for. I'll wait. I'll come up one of the, it will come up one of these days. I'll find a way to bring it up. Christmas is coming." Well, that's just, you know, built, I mean, and this is really, a bunch of this is right out of Ron's life. Now, when I say, you know, making up your life as you go along, also there's some fabrication in there, and I want to end on that note, that we are not journalists. This is expressive writing. We are not Joe Friday. We are not here to collect only the facts. Okay? We are artists. And so we take memory, and we take experience, and we take things that we feel strongly about, and so on, and then we do what's, oh, I know this is the other phrase I wanted to hand you 3 minutes ago. We do what one writer has called making it more true. Never confuse, when something's written in the first person singular, never confuse that I speaker with the author. Now, many of my poems are in first person, and other pieces of things that I write. And I would say of many of them that they're nearly like me, that speaker is nearly me. But it's really not completely me. It's made up a lot of me. But it's not completely me. Did he actually live in a house that cost $72.50 a month? I don't know. You know, knowing Ron, probably so. And knowing that area, probably so. But that's not important for the pulling the thing together. So once we have the stuff out on the table, you know, once we remember the kitchen, we've got the, you know, places, the people, the objects, and the faucets, and all the stuff out there. Then we can tinker with that a little bit. That's the artfulness of it. It doesn't mean we're lying, okay? But we're making it more true. I'd invite you to kind of think about that phrase a little bit. So stage one, you know, is get it out there as honestly as we can. But stage two might be to help it along a little bit, you know, to help it become its best self, this piece that we're sort of holding here and delivering into the world. Any remarks, comments, confusions, things you want to take me to task for?
Like embroidery, could you use that term?
Well, I guess that could be, yeah. I guess that, I don't want to
overstate that, but yeah, I think that's one way to put it. For example, suppose you're writing and one of the persons who is in the room is your granddad. And, you know, after you've got real granddad there and all this stuff is surrounding and the interchanges are going on between people, let's say your granddad didn't have a walrus mustache, but you think this would go a little better if we saw that. Mm-hmm. Grow a mustache, for goodness sake, you know.
Yeah.
It's okay. If you want to have something, you know, that's factual and something to leave the family and that kind of thing, that's one set of stuff. But if you want to, you know, move it into, you know, art writing, expressive writing, and then, you know, is something that that you can shape, you have that. I mean, I want to re-stress that phrase. You can shape it, you know. Is it fibbing? Well, probably it's fibbing, but it's not that. I mean, we never intended to be these writing for these writing sessions to be journalistic, you know. We never intended for them to be solely therapeutic. They are therapeutic, but we never intended for them to be solely that. Mm-hmm.
There's a good book out called Inventing the Truth that's edited by William Zinsser, and he takes five, I guess the new edition he does more, maybe seven authors that you would recognize, Russell Baker and Annie Dillard and yeah. Toni Morrison, and they talk about this very fact. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. Yeah. I'd recommend it if you're
okay.
And that's William Zinsser.
Inventing the Truth.
Inventing the Truth. I've never read that, but I've heard the title of it. Other remarks, or I'd kind of like this to end up with you closing instead of me.
I'd like to see this. I really would like to see this kind of thing become something that would be up here.
Mm-hmm. You know, whether or not it included me, I'd like for it to. I mean, there's lots of writers that they can have up here. They can even have more than one at a time.
That'd be interesting to have different kinds. Someone that was specialized in poetry, historical.
Reflective
essay.
Is there ever a sign-up sheet for this group here that's here? Because
no.
This group here, I mean, the people that are right here that are interested, even if only one out of 10 came, they certainly would be the ones that would focus on making.
Well, we can pass a sheet around, and if you want to, you know, just sign up.
That's oftentimes the kind of thing that somebody says, I want to do a writing conference,
yeah.
and it will happen next year.
Well, we'll do this easily. If you think that's a dandy idea and want to put your name on it, or if you don't want to put your name on it, but you want to put somebody else's name on it.